I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. If you support marriage equality, you've had a lot to celebrate since Election Day last week. Voters in Maine, Maryland, and Washington have now joined six other states and Washington, D.C. by approving same-sex marriage ballots. Voters in Minnesota rejected a proposed constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. There are now six openly gay representatives in the U.S. House, and the U.S. Senate has its first openly gay senator, Tammy Baldwin, Democrat from Wisconsin. Polls show that there is growing support for LGBT equality in some, but not all parts of the country. 30 states still have constitutional bans on same-sex marriage. Well, today on Radio Times, we take stock of what the voters said and did last week and look ahead to the future challenges for LGBT Americans. And we have three guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studios is Tobias Barrington-Wolf. He's a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. He served as the chief advisor on lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues in the 2007-2008 presidential campaign of Barack Obama, and he's been an informal advisor to the White House since President Obama took office. And Tobias, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me back.
Also joining us by telephone is Brian Sims. He's a Democratic member of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, serving the 182nd district in Philadelphia. He's the first openly gay state legislator in Pennsylvania. Brian Sims, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, Marty. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Carrie Elleveld. She's a writer and consultant who spent 4 years covering Barack Obama, first as a political reporter on the campaign trail and then as a White House correspondent for The Advocate. She's conducted three interviews with President Obama, two during the 2008 election and one in the Oval Office. And Carrie Elleveld, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Tobias, let me begin with you. And even looking back at the 2004 election, when 11 states approved anti-gay marriage referenda, and then we see what happened last week in three states this year's election, what do you think explains what has happened in those 8 years?
Boy, that's a big question. I think a lot of the progress that we have made on LGBT equality has to do fundamentally with the courageous willingness of individual people to tell their stories. I think any political movement and any civil rights movement depends upon people understanding an issue not just in abstract terms but in human terms. And when you're talking about a population that is subjected to discrimination and really serious and widespread discrimination, even to this day for LGBT Americans, telling your story often means putting yourself at risk, either putting yourself in material risk when it comes to the possibility you might lose your job, and also, you know, making people confront an issue that they might not want to confront. And a lot of what we've seen, I think, in the last 8 years has been a continuing willingness on the part of people from every walk of life to simply step up and say, this is who we are, and this is the effect that these laws are having upon our family and our lives, and we need to do something about that. And that more than anything else, I think, is what drives progress.
Do you agree with that, Brian Sims?
I actually agree wholeheartedly, and I'll take it one step further. I think that, you know, we've known for a long time that probably the most important thing that you can do to affect those people around you when it comes to LGBT issues and LGBT civil rights is simply to come out. What I think that we've seen over the last 10 years or so is, as exposure of LGBT people has increased, what it's allowed is it's allowed our allies to come out as well. You know, 25, 30 years ago, it was really hard to be an ally of LGBT people. You were sort of subject to some of the same discrimination that they were. You know, hey, Marty, I saw you hanging out with Brian. Are you gay too? You know, now that's not so much the case. And so what's happened is, in the last 10 years, our allies have come out in full force. You know, in the last 2 years, we saw the commander-in-chief support the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We have a vice president who has supported marriage equality, a secretary of state who said it's a human rights issue. I think in being able to tell our stories, our allies are now able to tell theirs.
To you, Carrie Elleveld, I wonder whether there's also a generational shift. When you look at, you know, polling, broadly speaking, and you look at people in their 20s and 30s, they seem to have a different perspective on this issue than their parents and grandparents.
Well, yeah, and that is so true. And, you know, I think a lot of people are familiar with the polling, and you know, some, like 65% of young people, for instance, support same-sex marriage, whereas as you go up, you know, and those are voters between the ages of, like, 18 and 35, and as you go up in age, there's, you know, the support goes falls down less and less. But it has been growing overwhelmingly over the course of the last 4 years, not in small part because the president himself came out and supported same-sex marriage. But I would also say that, you know, a lot of the older generations, even the Gen Xers and up into the baby boomers and older, sort of thought of gay issues as one sort of issue, one voting issue. It was sort of other. But I think that especially with the millennials, this younger generation, the youngest one coming up, they really feel like this isn't just one issue. It's sort of intrinsic. Equality is intrinsic to who they are. They have friends. They know friends who are gay, who are lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and they think they should have the same rights as anybody else does because they don't view them as any different. And so it's not, you know, it's sort of like I think in this election you could look at Mitt Romney and you could say a lot of voters said, he just doesn't get me because he's, you know, has a lot of wealth and, you know, I'm middle class or I'm working class and he just doesn't get me. This is very similar, I think, to how young people think about LGBT issues, which is when a politician doesn't support LGBT issues and isn't proactive on LGBT issues, they just sort of think, this person doesn't get me. This man, this woman, whoever they are, they don't get me. And so it's not an other issue for younger Americans.
And Tobias, looks like you want to add something.
Yeah. I also, building very much on what Brian and Carrie just said, there's one obligation that we have that I think it's important never to forget, which is our obligation to young LGBT kids and teenagers. And I think that the impetus to encourage people to come out and to talk about who they are, which I agree is very important, and the fact, which is indeed a fact, that there is a generational shift happening here, should never blind us to the fact that LGBT youth are some of the most vulnerable members of our community, and that, in fact, in vastly disproportionate numbers, LGBT kids suffer from homelessness, suffer from abuse, and have access to fewer resources and fewer sources of support. And so, you know, given that we are putting out the very important message that, you know, come out and embrace the fact that you can be who you are without having feelings of shame around that, that carries with it a very high responsibility on the part of those of us who are already safe to be working to make available sources of support and assistance to the kids who can endanger themselves in a much more immediate way by doing what we're inviting them to do, which is to live in a truthful way.
Gary, and I want to hear from you, Brian, as well, but do you see this as a bottom-up movement? And by that I mean that if people are coming out, just, you know, regular folks are being honest and open about who they are, that has actually affected leadership in this country?
Yeah, absolutely. And let's be clear about what happened coming into 2008, right? When we came into 2008 off this historic election of President Barack Obama's, obviously, in our history, and I think, we were, as a country, elated about that. Gays also suffered this huge setback in California where Proposition 8, you know, invalidated same-sex marriage or the right to same-sex marriage there, which had already been granted. And I think this was a huge wake-up call. And it really mobilized LGBT activists, in my mind, to think, okay, this isn't going to be handed to us. We have some hard work to continue doing. And it's fair to note, I mean, all of these issues are not created equal, right? There's a lot of issues that remain to be solved in terms of making LGBT people full American citizens with the same rights and privileges and every.
You know what, Carrie, we're going to get you on a better phone because your phone is clicking in and out, and I want to make sure that our listeners hear what you have to say. So we're going to call you back. Brian, let me turn to you and the same kind of question, and even putting it into a political context. When Barack Obama was running for president, he opposed gay marriage, said he was essentially evolving on that issue. Earlier this year in May, he did come out in support of gay marriage. I've wondered whether his vice president outed him on that or not. But how significant do you think it has been for the president to be open that way? And even as he was running for office, I noticed when he talked about groups of people, he always included LGBT Americans.
Well, you know, I think it was actually very significant in two different ways. I think first is, you know, this issue of evolving on policy, evolving on issues, somehow we got away from that. And I don't know if it was under the previous presidency where we would, you hear people say, hey, you know, I may not agree with what they believe, but at least they stick to their guns. And, you know, whereas I appreciate that from all politicians, but I also want to see personal growth. And I think that what the president did is showed the country that politicians can evolve on issues. You don't have to have the same stance on an issue 10 years from now that you do now, and you can change, and that's what experience is. It's being exposed to new things. It's understanding new things and applying those to your values, applying those to your ethics. So I think that first, the president showed us that people can evolve on these issues and that it doesn't hurt you, and it's not a sign of being morally weak. In fact, it might be a sign of being morally strong. But I think secondly is he gave a bunch of cover. You know, Tobias could certainly speak to this, and I'm sure Kerry could too. But, you know, Democrats in leadership roles all across the country have been supportive of marriage equality now for some years, and it's a hard thing to sometimes talk about. If the national party doesn't support it, if the leader of the party isn't supporting it, are you rogue for talking about your support of marriage equality? And when the president came out and said that he did believe in marriage equality, I think it allowed all of those elected officials, all those people in positions to leverage their values in favor of LGBT civil rights to feel all the more comfortable in being vocal about doing so.
But Tobias, do you think he did it for political reasons or even financial reasons?
Well, I think that part of what is significant about the president's embrace of marriage equality is that he transformed the conventional political wisdom by making his announcement. The day before he made his announcement, the conventional wisdom was that this was risky, this was dangerous, this was going to be a close election, a hard-fought election. It was an election about the economy and jobs, and taking a stand on an issue that threatened to detract from a message about the economy was risky, and Mitt Romney had a very strong, hostile, anti-gay position, which might fire up a base that was otherwise not particularly convinced of his bona fides. And the day after the president made his announcement, it was clear that he had simply thrown that political conventional wisdom out the window. On the fundraising side, absolutely not. I mean, I am not primarily a funder or a fundraiser, but the amount of just breathtaking progress that this administration has made in its first 4 years on tangible LGBT rights issues, insofar as there's a relationship between deliverables and people's willingness to support a candidate financially, the deliverables were definitely already there.
We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Tobias Barrington Wolf, the voice you just heard, Brian Sims, and Carrie Elleveld. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the University of Southern California, announcing the USC Gloria Kaufman School of Dance, the new home for contemporary and classical dance, built with a transformative gift from Gloria Kaufman. More at kaufman.usc.edu.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday, John Dowell and his musical ensemble will perform. Dowell, whose work is on view in the exhibition Full Spectrum, Prints from the Brandywine Workshop, has been exploring the relationships between improvising music and painting since the mid-60s. In his work, he focuses on the use of colors, rhythms, space, texture, shapes, harmony, and emotions. Beginning at 5:45. More details are available at philamuseum.org.
In 1989, five young African-American and Latino teenagers confessed to a terrible crime, raping and beating a young white woman. The problem is they didn't do it.
Once you have a person broken down to the point that they just want to get out of a room, then you can pretty much get them to say anything.
Raymond Santana is featured in a new film about the case, and he tells us more about it next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Tate Weller, Certified Public Accountant, celebrates 90 years of specialized audit, tax, and advisory services to national and global nonprofit and financial services clients. TAITWeller.com. Tate Weller. Focus. Expertise. Results.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're talking about the fact that national polls are showing that the American public is moving slowly but surely in favor of gay rights and marriage equality. That was certainly evident at some of the votes last week. When three states approved same-sex marriage, the U.S. Congress increased the number of members who are openly gay. We're talking about what explains this shift, where it's going, and what it all means. Our guests are Tobias Barrington Wolf, a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, worked in the 08 Obama campaign. Brian Sims is the first openly gay state legislator in Pennsylvania, representing the 182nd District in Philadelphia. And Carrie Elleveld is a writer and consultant who covered candidate and President Obama for The Advocate. And we have calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. Carrie, hoping we have a better phone line. But what's interesting, though, when you look at the polling, and I'm looking at something from the Washington Post, ABC, 51% of the country in favor of same-sex marriage, 47% of the country opposed to same-sex marriage. And when you look across the country, you do see regional differences. The Northeast is very different from the South. What does that tell us?
Well, what that tells us is that the Northeast is a more progressive part of the country on these issues, and it's fair. What I think is really important about that is we must remember, as historic a night as we had, on this election night in 2012, there were three states in which people gained more rights in terms of being recognized for their same-sex marriages. But across the country, while there was a lot of good feeling in terms of actual tangible rights, there weren't that many people that were affected. It was highly important. It was highly symbolic. It shows what the trajectory is, right? But in terms of these states in the south, the southern regional of the country and other areas of the country are sort of behind. People don't have employment, non-discrimination protections. They don't have same-sex marriage rights. They don't have rights that, in same-sex marriage nationwide, is still, those rights are not recognized by the federal government because the, Federal Defense of Marriage Act. I want to go back real quickly, Marty, and
sure.
I hope you can hear me now.
Yes.
I think it's fair to say that Tobias Wolf and I have, a distinctly different view on how some of these changes came about within the Obama administration. And, Tobias, to his credit, was pushing from the inside and advising the administration from the inside. I was covering the movement from the outside, and I think it is critically important that people understand that LGBT activism, people on the ground, people who were, outside of Washington, played a huge role in bringing Washington along, even during these 4 years. The president did a courageous thing when he came out in favor of same-sex marriage, and it did flip the conventional wisdom, and Tobias is right about that. But coming into this administration, Washington was woefully behind the times, not necessarily on same-sex marriage, but certainly on repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which was polling at least 70% across the nation. And it took near, 2 years of hand-to-hand combat to try to get Washington to bring that across the line. And, of course, they brought repeal across the line just within the last few days of the 111th Congress. And if it hadn't happened then, it never would have happened in the 112th Congress because Republicans took over control of the House.
Mm.
It was critically important, the activism that happened, the people that protested, the people that wrote letters, the people that continued to press their lawmakers. This was important. It was important in terms of Barack Obama. It was also important in terms of Congress.
Do you agree with that, Tobias? And Brian, I want to get you in on this as well, but go ahead, Tobias.
So despite my desire to make for some good radio by having some real hand-to-hand combat here, I agree much more with my friend Carrie than than she might have indicated. I absolutely believe that on-the-ground activism, and activism that both is pushing on specific issues, but also that is creating the kind of political infrastructure that we need at the state level and at the national level, has been and continues to be key in getting change done both at the state level and the national level. And I think that a lot of the activism specifically around the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell had a significant impact upon key members of Congress. And where Carrie and I might differ somewhat is in the both energy and the systematic effort within the administration to put together the coalition of actors that was necessary in order to get the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell through Congress. And what I had the great privilege to see firsthand in working with the White House and working with senior members of the Pentagon and also in working with members of Congress, it was somewhat different from the story that Kerry has told. But having said that, I would never want to be understood as – I mean, look, the president himself has said from the first time he ran for office that part of the job of activists is to push hard to make clear what their priorities are and to both provide tools but also provide pressure to make sure the administration is focusing on those priorities. And I wholeheartedly endorse that.
Brian Sims, let me get you back in on the conversation. You're the first openly gay state legislator in Pennsylvania. What is top on your to-do list while you're in Harrisburg?
To be very honest, the first thing on my to-do list is to make sure that every one of my colleagues knows that I'm here and that I'm out. You know, I am in the minority party, and as I'm very fond of telling people in Pennsylvania, you know, talking for us about marriage equality is way ahead of where we should be. I am, despite being in a relatively northeast state, I have a state that doesn't have any statewide LGBT civil rights. I was, the day that the president came out and announced his support for marriage, I was sitting in the office at the National Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund in Washington, D.C. And the Victory Fund has, for the last 21 years, focused exclusively on electing out LGBT officials, not just because of the esoterics, not just because of the sort of representative democracy ideals of it, but also because of the metrics of it. Electing out people has a tangible effect on the civil rights propagated by the bodies that they're elected to. And so, you know, I know that so much of the gains that we've seen over the last 5 and 10 years have actually been at the statewide level. You know, anti-bullying legislation, hate crimes legislation, non-discrimination legislation, we've seen these things move. You know, and what it's done, I think, is, you know, Americans don't necessarily know how they feel about marriage equality. They don't necessarily know how they feel about LGBT adoption, a whole slew of LGBT issues. But they do know that the government should not be in the business of allowing discrimination. So, you know, we've started with non-discrimination. We've moved to anti-bullying. We've moved to hate crimes. And is the natural next extension marriage equality? Sure. But as you said at the top of the hour, there are 30 states right now that have banned marriage equality, and we not only have to remove those pieces of legislation, we have to work to make sure that somebody isn't fired from their job for being gay, or that someone can't get kicked out of their apartment for being gay, and then we can, and especially in my state, then we can focus on recognizing the sanctity of their relationships.
I thought it was interesting that Tammy Baldwin, now the U.S. senator from Wisconsin, when she was running, said, "I didn't run to," I guess when she won the nomination or won the job as senator, "I didn't run to make history. I ran to make a difference."
And I couldn't agree more. She, you know, Tammy Baldwin often quotes Barney Frank, and it's a great line. And he says, "If you don't have a seat at the table, you are probably on the menu." And in so many states, and certainly in the federal government for quite a long time, we were on the menu. I believe now that there are out elected officials in all 50 states. The four largest states in the country that had never elected out people to their state legislatures did in this last election cycle. And so I think what we're seeing is a recognition that, as Tammy Baldwin would say, if you're not in the room, you're being talked about, and if you're in the room, you're being talked with.
And that's Brian Sims. He's the first openly gay state legislator in Pennsylvania, a Democrat representing the 182nd District in Philadelphia. Carrie Elleveld is a writer consultant who has spent 4 years covering Barack Obama and has been a correspondent for The Advocate. And Tobias Barrington Wolf is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. And we are talking about LGBT Americans and rights and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Tina from Yardley to join us. And Tina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just want to applaud your guests. I mean, Brian and Tobias and Carrie, I'm loving the conversation and glad you're giving me an opportunity to share.
Sure.
My question has to deal with party lines and the obviously vast majority between the difference between Republicans and Democrats. I consider myself a part of the LGBT youth community, definitely side with the Democratic Party. But my question deals with the Republican Party and the conservative base, which is what I know about it anyway, in that they don't want government involvement in their lives. They want the government to be separate from your daily decisions, you fend for yourself. So my question deals with how can they get away with the hypocrisy by then inserting the government and saying that two women or two men cannot be married.
Well, Tina, I don't think we have any Republicans on the show today, but I hear your question and I've heard it before. I think it
can
bears.
I take a stab?
What's that? You can, Carrie. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, so you know, I mean, you are absolutely right about the conservative notion of no government interference in personal lives, and you know, the Republicans have sort of thrown that by the wayside over the years, and especially during the culture wars. In order to sort of woo the Christian conservative, right? But what I think is important is, I mean, the writing is starting to be on the wall now, and I think even Republicans, I mean, to a greater extent on an issue like immigration, but even on gay rights and LGBT equality, I think is starting to see the writing on the wall and where this is going. And Steve Schmidt, who was the chief advisor and architect of John McCain's run in 2008, and also was involved with George W. Bush in 2004, said in the New York Times just recently, "The die is cast on this issue. Why should we sign a suicide pact with the National Organization for Marriage?" And he's advocated for quite some time exactly what you're saying, which is that it is not a part of conservative values for the government to insert itself in people's personal lives. And I do think that even though there was a distinct difference between Mitt Romney and President Obama on the subject of LGBT equality, Mitt Romney during the primary, because he had to win conservatives, he had to win social conservatives, he signed this pledge from the National Organization of Marriage that he would promote a federal marriage amendment, which was a constitutional marriage amendment prohibiting same-sex marriages. But during the general election, they did not go out and campaign on this issue vociferously. They tried to avoid it at all costs. And I think that, you know, that is a sign of where the Republican Party is headed, not nearly quickly enough, but hopefully soon.
Tina, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me toss this to you, Tobias, and even throw in something that you had said to me before the show began, wondering if there is a connection between some of these LGBT issues and some of the issues related to women that came up during the presidential campaign.
Absolutely. And so as another response to Tina's question, I see a big difference between Republican elected officials and professional politicos and Republican people, that is to say people who are not involved in the political process. Elected officials and professional political operatives know very well that this anti-big government language is being deployed at the very least selectively, and I think it's fair to say hypocritically. I'm less interested in making that charge against people who are not themselves professional politicians, because I think it's an available vocabulary with which people talk about their resistance to an issue. And instead of trying to make them look like hypocrites because of the language they're using, I think we should ask the question, why are they resistant? Right. And, you know, the dedicated opponents of LGBT equality, I just want to push back against them. But the people out there who are not yet with us, I want to figure out what it is that we need to do to engage with them in order to make a difference. And that's where I think some of the connection comes with women's issues, with women's health issues, with equity issues in the workplace. We saw this extraordinary, extraordinary display of popular support for basic concepts of women's equality and women's dignity in this election cycle. It is undeniable that the overreach of the professional Republican Party resulted in their losing Senate seats that they otherwise would have won, and they're having major problems in states that were otherwise hard fought. And the connection there, at the very least, is a connection about attempting to use shame around sex and sexuality and attempting to use questions of gender and the expectations that you impose upon people because of their gender as a way of setting public policy. Mm-hmm. And I think that what this election demonstrated is that whatever it might have offered as a political opportunity in the past, it's very perilous to start trying to make sexual shame and gender stereotypes a basis for public policy, at least at the national level. And I think that the opportunities for both substantive and political coalition between LGBT people and women are really one of the next major opportunities that advocates need to be seizing upon in this particular moment.
Brian, let me toss something out tangentially related to what Carrie and Tobias were talking about, because I think when you look at some of the polling, and I hate to keep relying on polling, but it does give us a little bit of direction, that there is more support for things like civil unions than for same-sex marriage. And that for some people, for whatever reason, the idea of marriage is something that they don't want to give up. Do you understand someone that might be struggling with that?
Of course I understand it. You know, what I hear from time to time is people say, you know, marriage is, you know, the sanctity of marriage is so important. Well, that's exactly why we're fighting so hard for marriage equality. You know, I can't stress enough how much I agree with something Tobias just said about the difference between Republican people, everyday Republicans, and Republican political operatives. And I think it's true, actually, of people who are devoutly religious and the sort of the mechanisms of religion as well. You know, I have family and friends who are staunch Republicans who are extremely supportive of me as an LGBT person, and not just as an afterthought, who are proactively supportive of me as a gay person. But what they have been told by their party is that in order to be good Republicans, they must oppose my civil rights. And I think I'm going to make a prediction here. I think that one of the things that we learned in this election is that the Republicans' use of LGBT issues as a wedge issue is going to begin to go away. Mm. Not because of the veracity of their beliefs. It's not for me to question the authenticity of anybody's belief, but it's not going to be effective anymore. And it's going to be less and less effective as we move forward. And so, you know, Tina was 100% right to point out that this is an issue that still breaks heavily on party lines. It's important also to point out that, you know, Republicans in New York were instrumental in passing marriage equality. And, you know, even somebody like as divisive, quite frankly, as Governor Christie in New Jersey, he has a Democratic legislature, but he signed into law one of the strongest anti-bullying policies in the country. He also vetoed a marriage equality bill, but I don't think he's going to be able to do that in the next session in New Jersey. There is a big difference between the talking points and the actual ideology. We see it in American Catholics. You know, American Catholics are more supportive of LGBT relationship recognition than the American population as a whole, and people don't actually realize this.
Well, you know what? Only hold on to that, and all three of you have so many interesting things to say, but we have to take a very short break. That's Brian Sims, a Democratic member of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. He serves the 182nd District here in Philadelphia. Also with us is Carrie Elleveld, a writer-consultant who has written for The Advocate, covering President Obama when he was just a candidate and then in the White House. And also with us is Tobias Barrington-Wolf. He's a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. One open line at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Are you a breast cancer survivor? Do you have hot flashes? The Integrative Medicine Program at Penn Medicine is studying ways to improve the quality of life of breast cancer survivors. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of acupuncture or medication to treat hot flashes. Initial evaluations determine eligibility. To learn more about Penn's Integrative Medicine Program, 215-349-5647. 215-349-5647.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Congress holds closed-door hearings on the attacks in Benghazi. Also, a preview of the Latin Grammy Awards. Nominees include MacArthur genius Miguel Zenon. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
JerseyArts.com supports WHYY, featuring the American Repertory Ballet's production of The Nutcracker, now in its 49th season. Featuring Tchaikovsky's score, new set designs, and a cast of over 100. November 23rd through December 23rd at venues across New Jersey, including MacArthur Theater in Princeton, Patriots Theater in Trenton, and the State Theater in New Brunswick. A full schedule at arballet.org. The American Repertory Ballet, and more online at JerseyArts.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We're taking stock of what voters said and did last week when voters in Maine, Maryland, and Washington basically approved same-sex marriage ballots. Voters in Minnesota rejected a proposed constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. There are now six openly gay representatives in the U.S. House, and the U.S. Senate has its first openly gay senator, Tammy Baldwin, Democrat from Wisconsin. And we're talking about all of this with our guests, Tobias Barrington Wolf and Brian Sims and Carrie Elleveld. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to get some more callers on. Let me see what Bob from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. And Bob, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, everyone. Hi, Brian. I'm a member of GALF, Gay and Lesbian Leaders of Philadelphia, and I'm proud of our member, Brian Sims, for being the first out legislature in Pennsylvania. Congratulations again, Brian. In regards to the rights, and Brian pointed out briefly, there is no statewide protection in Pennsylvania for employment, housing, accommodations. We have a paper tiger law in Philadelphia, and then there's some municipalities that have it grown in Pennsylvania, and Delaware doesn't have protection either, and many states don't. One of the things that has been on the table since 1974 on the federal level is ENDA. It's called the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And it's been introduced for the last 20 years, since 94, and we have not been able to pass that. That's a key piece of legislation that needs to be passed, and we need to work on it. And I'm just wondering what some of the panelists think the strategy could be to move this forward, because President Obama supports this. And then, just as a side note, the Republicans do have people within the Republican Party, such as the Log Cabin and Republican Gay Group, that's been largely marginalized in the last few years, but there are people we can reach out to in the GOP and say, look, why don't we support this? It's time to do this. And the equality thing is just not about employment, housing, accommodations. It's economic, it's social, it's spiritual. And then when people say, well, we don't want gay marriage because it's against our spiritual aspects, well, marriage involves more than just spiritual. It's economic, it's social. And there are some people that are not part of an organized religion, and that's another aspect.
Sure, Bob. We could go on and on. I got to jump in here only because I've got three loquacious guests, and I'm sure that they all want to weigh in on what you said, especially about the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And Brian, since he mentioned you, let me hear from you, then from Carrie, and then from Tobias.
Well, you know, it's a great question that Bob has raised, and that is, you know, what. Sort of methodology do we finally get full civil rights, LGBT civil rights. As Carrie said earlier, it's not really one thing. This is a collection of things. It's changing not just laws, it's changing the culture. You know, we've had opportunities before to move on ENDA, and for whole hosts of reasons have not been able to do it. I think one of the things that I always want to make sure about is that as we're having this discussion about marriage equality, and we're having it all across the country at the state and federal level, that we are also recognizing that there are states and the federal government that still allows discrimination towards LGBT people. Ted Martin, who is the executive director of Equality Pennsylvania, has this great line, and he says, here in Pennsylvania, for us to go to marriage equality right now would be like going from a tricycle to the space shuttle. There is so much ground that we need to make up in between, and I think that, you know, in answer to Bob's question, what do we need to do? Obviously, we need to continue to pressure the White House. We need to continue to pressure Congress, but we're now being able to do it both inside the Capitol and, as we've always been doing it, outside the Capitol. You know, having Tammy Baldwin in the Senate is much more than just a PR win, and I think having her be able to push for a trans-inclusive end from the Senate side. We've got now six members in the U.S. House that are pushing from the House side. I really do think that ENDA is perhaps the next big step, other than the cases behind DOMA, the case law that's going to happen with the fall of DOMA. But I really do think that ENDA is the next legislative step for Congress to take.
And Carrie, just so our audience knows, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act basically protects from workplace discrimination, so you can't be, quote-unquote, I guess, fired for being out?
Yeah, get fired for being gay or for your gender identity, gender presentation. Listen, it's good that you define that, because here's one of the problems. 90% of Americans think these protections already exist on the federal level. 90% of Americans already think that. So that's point number one. Point number two is, you know, it's true that ENDA has lagged for you know, more than 30 years, and it's changed over that time. But one thing is, in 1941, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as president, set forth, he articulated an ideal for the American people when he stipulated that defense contractors must have protections for African Americans in the workplace. They cannot discriminate against African Americans in the workplace. President Obama could do the same thing. Let's remember, he did that in 1941, FDR did, and it wasn't until the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that came to full fruition. Employment protections based on race came to full fruition, right? So President Obama could do that very same thing today, and he could have done it during any of his first, during any of his first four years while he's still in his first. He could do it. He could still do it in his first term. Sign an executive order that protected, that required federal contractors to have protections for LGBT people in the workplace. This would articulate an ideal. It would start a national discussion that needs to be had very badly, and it would start in motion what needs to happen in Congress. And one last thing I will say about ENDA, we've been trying for years to push this through the House first. We have 55 Democrats in the Senate right now. We do not have control of the House. I think we should push to see a vote on this, an up or down vote on this, even if we lose, even if Republicans won't get on board. If Republicans want to filibuster this, it is such a basic American fairness that you should be able to go to work, do a good job, and not be fired for some ancillary issue, that I would welcome seeing the Republicans filibuster this issue. It would raise a national conversation that needs to be had.
Let me toss something else. I know you want to say something about that, Tobias, but we haven't really talked about the Defense of Marriage Act. And it looks like, I'm not sure whether the U.S. Supreme Court is going to rule on this, but this was something that came out from the Clinton administration in 1996, prohibiting the federal government from recognizing same-sex marriage in states and foreign countries where those marriages are performed. Do you think the court will take this? And do you have any read on how they might rule?
It's very likely they'll take the case. Two federal courts of appeal now have declared the statute unconstitutional, the First Circuit and the Second Circuit, both importantly in opinions written by conservative judges, Republican appointees, Judge Boudin in the First Circuit, a very highly respected intellectual conservative, and Chief Judge Jacobs in the Second Circuit, who is a very strongly conservative judge, which is, I think, a nice posture in which the court will be considering the case. It's very hard for the court not to hear an appeal when a federal statute is declared unconstitutional by multiple circuits. Mm-hmm. What is the likely outcome? Look, I'll say this. This is a very careful, very surgically deployed lawsuit. GLAD and the folks in the Second Circuit case, who include my old law firm, who are pro bono counsel in this case, have done a fantastic job in framing the issues in a way that invites the court to strike down this discriminatory statute as a sort of incremental step towards the recognition of full equality for LGBT people under the Constitution. Let me just very quickly say on the employment discrimination front, two very quick issues that we haven't yet mentioned. First is, in the spring of this past spring, the commissioners of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission issued an authoritative opinion that said that when it comes to gender identity discrimination in the workplace, the existing protections of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibit sex discrimination, also prohibit anti-transgender discrimination and gender identity discrimination. It's a very important fact. It has not gotten as much attention in the popular press as I think it deserved, and I think we should never forget that fact and fail. You know, it doesn't take any of the urgency away from the issue, but we shouldn't fail to recognize that there is a major advance there on the front of gender identity discrimination. And the second is enacting ENDA is a very important priority. ENDA is not as great of a statute as it could be. There are limits on the protections that the statute offers that are a result of the fact that it's been floating around in Congress for 30-odd years and has been kind of tweaked in various ways to try to make it more politically palatable. Should we still enact the statute if we can? Absolutely. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it is not as robust protection as LGBT employees and workers really deserve.
But do you think the president should do what Kerry advised?
Oh, with respect to an executive order. The president is very strongly on record supporting an executive order, and I fully expect that that is going to be an issue that gets taken up in a serious way.
Let me get Steve from Reading to join our conversation. And, Steve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm a can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm a pastor of the United Church of Christ congregation in Reading, Pennsylvania, and our denomination allows our churches to ordain people who are gay and, of course, welcome into full participation. Our church does that. And we are very much, many of us here are very much for marriage equality. And I guess what I wanted to say is that a lot of this is really this agenda is being pushed by certain segments of the Christian community, and not all Christians agree with them about that. Many of us really understand it from a constitutional point of view, but also from a religious point of view, that there really is no such thing as biblical marriage the way it's practiced in this country.
Well, Steve, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Brian, any comments you want to say back to Steve?
I think that Steve raises a very good point, and that is that in many ways this is about you'll hear churches say, hey, that if you force marriage equality upon us, it's counter to our religious freedoms. And this is a freedom of religion issue, but in as Steve just pointed out, there are churches, there are religious communities all over the country that want to be marrying LGBT people and that are not allowed because of essentially the prevailing values of just a couple of religions. And I think that's really, really important to point out. You know, here in Pennsylvania, really the sole lobbying opposition to LGBT civil rights does come from the religious right. You know, every Sunday about 2:00, half the legislators in Pennsylvania get swamped with those little cards that people fill out as they're leaving their church services. And, you know, I know from polling in this state that, you know, this is a state that actually does support LGBT civil rights, at least it supports non-discrimination. And you wouldn't know that if you just looked at our legislature or listened to our legislators, and it's really because the talking points that they are carrying from the religious right that is lobbying against this, and that is, again, it really is the sole lobbying opposition to equality here, at least in my state.
Go ahead, Tobias.
And it's urgently important for people to understand that none of the reforms, legislative reforms, judicial decisions, none of them that speak to the relationship rights of same-sex couples have anything to do with what churches are going to be required to do with respect to administering the sacrament of marriage. And as important as it is, as a cultural matter, for us to be having conversations about pro-equality, welcoming, embracing churches like the UCC pastor who just called in, We should never, ever make the mistake of buying into the notion that recognizing the equal rights of same-sex couples is going to require churches to change their religious doctrines. And in fact, when you make that distinction clear in polling, then the support for marriage equality and other forms of equal treatment goes way up. And one of the strategies of opponents is to try to confuse those two issues together.
Carrie, something you mentioned earlier, and I want to make sure we don't that we do justice to this, which is ending discrimination when it comes to adoption. Can you help us understand that better?
Discrimination attorney. You know, I actually am going to defer to Tobias on that.
Okay.
I would like to make one point.
Go ahead.
I would like to make one point on this marriage issue, and I want to thank that caller for calling in. It, you know, Tobias makes a great point, and what we're talking about here is federal benefits, right? The federal government being able to recognize state-sanctioned marriages. But it's also important to note that LGBT welcoming ministries and those religious institutions that were supportive of same-sex marriage played a huge role in achieving marriage equality in Maryland and Washington, D.C. And so, you know, people getting active and saying, wait a second, this isn't part of my Christian value system, this isn't part of my golden rule, is very important.
Tobias, is there a short answer? We've done whole shows about adoption. A short answer to this?
Well, the short answer is that equal treatment in the adoption context is not linked necessarily to marriage and marriage equality. And I'll give one specific example. One of the stories that opponents of LGBT equality often tell is that that Catholic Charities got out of the business of providing abortion services in Massachusetts because Massachusetts recognized marriage equality for same-sex couples. It's just not true. It was a simple application of an anti-discrimination law and an anti-discrimination policy that said if you're providing this service, regardless of the marital status of the people involved, you can't discriminate against gay parents or gay prospective parents. And that was the issue over which an unfortunate sort of conservative takeover of the governing board of those adoption services got them out of that business. You know, adoption is about providing good homes for kids who need them. And I think that in addition to the equal treatment of gay and lesbian prospective parents, it's simply cruel to be using kids as pawns in public policy discussions in this way. It is very clear that gay and lesbian people are just as good parents as straight people are, all other things held equal. And what we should be talking about is how to provide for kids, not how to use kids as political pawns.
Well, we could go on, and on that note, we have to end our conversation. My thanks to you, Tobias Barrington-Wolf, and to you, Brian Sims, and to you, Carrie Elleveld. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And Tobias Barrington-Wolf is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. He served as chief advisor on lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues in the 2007-2008 presidential campaign of Barack Obama. He's been an informal advisor to the White House ever since. Brian Sims, a Democratic member of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. And Carrie Elleveld, a writer and consultant who has covered Barack Obama and has written for The Advocate. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Bob Ball is the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. We had help from Jared Brausch today. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for those phone calls.